Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 159 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm or download the MP3 after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast aggregators. You can also listen to any of the last 5 episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. You will be responsible for any long-distance charges. Remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you would like to sponsor the show as an individual or advertiser, please contact me. You can donate via PayPal using the email david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com or see theinfectiousmyth.com/donate.php for more information. If you want to make monthly donations, please go to patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Even a few dollars a month helps. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you're gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on just about any of the topics I've covered in my shows, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. Somehow I managed to overlook a little bit of feedback from the July 19th show on David Smith talking about genital autonomy, i.e. opposed to male circumcision. Richard wrote, "Great job getting the message out there. A difficult subject well put across. Heartfelt thanks from the organization Men Do Complain." James wrote, "Thank you, David Smith, for helping expose the myths and lies that promote male genital mutilation." Today I'm going to talk to Professor Chris Shaw, an expert in aluminum's effects on the body, and brave enough to consider how injecting aluminum in vaccines could have negative effects on humans. He recently had a paper on vaccines, autism, and aluminum, withdrawn under somewhat strange circumstances. Rather than just let the implication stand that this was due to the fact that he is a, quote, vaccine denialist, end quote, I thought it would be good to talk to him. He was extremely difficult to get a hold of, which led to two things. First of all, the interview was relatively short, but more importantly, it took place in a coffee shop, so there's a lot of background noise. My apologies for this, and I hope you can still, however, hear the conversation. Chris Shaw is a professor in the Department of Ophthalmology at Vancouver General Hospital, University of British Columbia, in Vancouver, Canada. His laboratory has studied neurological diseases such as ALS, Parkinson's-like disease found in Guam and the Western Pacific. His attention was drawn to the neurological impact of aluminum, and more recently, the impact of injecting aluminum as a component of vaccines. This got him and his colleagues in trouble with an article that was retracted by the mainstream journal Vaccine, but then republished in the mainstream journal Immunological Research. Now another retraction has occurred on a study of aluminum in mice, so I wanted to talk about the reasons for that and what part of the research is still reliable. For your information, Dr. Shaw was previously interviewed on the show in October, 2 years ago, episode 75. Welcome back to the show, Chris. In mythology, the dog Cerberus guards the gates of hell. In real life, David Gorski guards the gates of medical orthodoxy, and he called your recent voluntarily retracted paper anti-vaccine pseudoscience. So right. Can you respond to that? That charge. It's not uncommon rhetoric for him. But.
No, it's not uncommon rhetoric. Basically, Dr. Gorski calls anything he doesn't like vaccine pseudoscience. He is very uncritical when it comes to things that would be probably more described, better described as pseudoscience coming from the CDC, and looks askance at anything that goes, in the different direction of talking about vaccine safety. I mean, he has his opinions. I think he's fairly ignorant about a lot of things to do with neuroscience and with aluminum toxicity. Apart from that, I mean, he can blog whatever he likes. But, I mean, his use of derogatory terms to deal with things he doesn't like is, it's not very professional. And dealing with blogs is a mug's game. Bloggers don't deal with the same guidelines that reviewers do. So when Gorski says, if I had reviewed it, I would have killed this paper, well, great. You know, then you can write to John Dawson or whoever and ask to be a reviewer.
Right. I mean, I think he's useful to Retraction Watch, because Retraction Watch would not have said this paper is anti-vaccine pseudoscience. But by
that was him.
Yeah,
that
by
was
quoting Gorski, they can get away with putting that in their headline. Right?
Absolutely. I mean, and you know, he does that a lot. But I mean, he says anything, again, that he disagrees with is pseudoscience. So, for example, when he goes after Yehuda Schoenfeld, who is, you know, the father of, you know, he's the head of the Autoimmunity Congress and, you know, one of the main lights in autoimmunity research in the world, when he says Yehuda Schoenfeld is anti-vaccine and a pseudoscientist, that's complete BS, because Schoenfeld is one of the firmest believers in vaccination policy that I know. When he says the work coming out of the Girardi lab is pseudoscience, you know, the same sort of thing applies. These are medical doctors that firmly believe in vaccination, but recognize that there are downsides for some people to mass vaccination.
Right. I think nowadays if you say, I'm in favor of vaccination, but not every vaccine, all at the same time, things like that, that you can be called a vaccine denialist.
You absolutely can. But it's weird because, you know, if I or anyone else says, look, antibiotics get overused and you don't prescribe them for everything, and by the way, some people shouldn't take penicillin or other antibiotics because of allergic reactions, you know, you're not instantly slammed as being against antibiotics. I mean, it's ridiculous how far the polarity in vaccine research has gone to the point where it's a religious orthodoxy. And if you don't, it's like, I guess, any other religious orthodoxy. If you don't toe the line 100%, you're out of the church.
And I mean, when people who are in favor of vaccines say, you know, they're well studied, et cetera, how can you have something well studied when you're not allowed to take a position that this might be a problem or I should investigate to see if it's a problem?
Precisely correct. So, you know, the idea that in science anything, any subject is ever closed is not true, and it's not a very scientific statement to make. The idea that you have to accept it just because the CDC said so is not a very scientific statement. These are articles of faith. These are not scientific positions. And science evolves and medicine evolves. Things we did 100 years ago, we don't do today. Things we do today, we won't do 100 years from now. So all these are evolving fields, and they evolve by questioning the orthodoxy. They don't evolve by, you know, blindly accepting orthodoxy.
Right.
And in many cases, by the way, you know, you examine the fundamental questions, and it turns out that the people that came before you were right. Some of those things seem to be correct. But that doesn't mean that they never get questioned again. And it really takes this whole thing about vaccination to a level that is really religious in nature and not really scientific.
Yes.
To say that there's nothing to question here.
Right. I mean, your paper probably would have got a lot of vaccine advocates' attentions, because the first words in it are autism spectrum disorder, and in the second paragraph you're talking about aluminum as an environmental toxin with demonstrated negative effects on human health, especially the nervous system, and autism, of course, is a nervous significant
disorder.
Nervous disorder.
Absolutely.
And the title of the paper in question is "Subcutaneous Injections of Aluminum at Vaccine Adjuvant Levels Activate Innate Immune Genes in Mouse Brain That Are Homologous with Biomarkers of Autism." So your title is connecting aluminum, or investigating the connection between aluminum and autism. So, apart from the title, what was this paper trying to do in your study?
Well, look, we've been looking at aluminum for a long time, and one of the roots of aluminum. I mean, we live in what Chris Exley, who's probably the leading biochemist who studies aluminum in the world, but he calls the age of aluminum. So aluminum surrounds us. It wasn't true 100 years ago, but it's true today.
Yes.
So it comes in processed food, it comes in formula for babies, it comes in vaccines, it comes in cosmetics, it comes in antiperspirants. No, it's in pills. It's all over the place. Mostly, when you're dealing with aluminum environmentally, and in the case, you know, for the, you know, a lot of the pro-vaccine people, is there's a lot more aluminum in a cup of tea than a vaccine, and that's true.
Right.
Deal with it differently. So what goes into your digestive system if you have a patent kidney function, you're going to get rid of most, if, you know, depending on age. So when you're very young and your kidneys aren't mature, you don't do it as well. When you're older and your kidneys are less functional, you don't do it as well.
Right.
And that may be why you look at the studies coming out of the Julie Walton lab in Australia, and she basically shows that older rats, not younger rats, that are given a lot of aluminum in their water will end up with things that look very much like an animal version of Alzheimer's disease. So aluminum is toxic, however it gets into your nervous system, but mostly it doesn't in most people under most circumstances.
Right.
When you inject aluminum, and this is well documented by the Girardi in Paris, when you inject aluminum, it has a very different pharmacokinetics. It gets picked up by circulating macrophages, it gets hauled through various places, and it winds up in the brain. So we know that, or at least we know it from the work coming from that group. And that group has demonstrated it time and time again.
And so, can I just quote from your paper? Compared to dietary aluminum, of which only about 0.25% is absorbed into systemic circulation, aluminum from vaccines may be absorbed at over 50% efficiency in the short term. I calculate that's a 200 times difference. So injected aluminum absorbed into the circulatory system 200 times more efficiently than aluminum in, say, a baby formula or some other oral method.
And it's very different. And it also depends on your genetics. Okay, so some people that carry different polymorphisms in certain genes are going to absorb and have more of it go into their CNS than others. So there is a wide population disparity given vaccination or given any other form. So, and for example, there what's emerging in Northern Ontario is a kind of a retrospective look at people who had aluminum inhalation. And what it turns out is that the mining companies, the hard rock miners, companies were worried about silicosis.
Right.
So because silicates, complex with aluminum, the idea was that if they breathed in aluminum dust, which people thought was harmless, if you breathe in aluminum dust, you can chelate the silicates and avoid silicosis. Well, A, that wasn't true, it didn't work.
Right.
But B, it really exposed these people to extremely high levels of aluminum. You know, they would breathe it every day going to work and coming out of work in the locker rooms. It was a deliberate policy and they had to do it. And now there is a wave of what looks like a series of neurological disorders associated with people who were exposed. But not everyone got it. So
right.
It very much depends on the individual and the individual genomics and metabolomics of that person. We don't know all those things.
And certainly any discussion of autism has to include the fact that the majority of people who receive vaccines don't get autism. So
absolutely.
If vaccines are the cause, it's obviously not a one-to-one, you know,
autism. And it's definitely not. And the same way with the Girardi group, they've just demonstrated that an aluminum adjuvant in vaccines in adults gives something called MMF, which stands for macrophagic myofasciitis, which is basically a neural disorder that's associated with the aluminum adjuvant. But not everybody gets it. And the same way, the Schoenfeld group has seen all kinds of adjuvant-associated autoimmune disorders, but not everyone gets it. So this is true for any neurological disease. Not everyone gets Alzheimer's because it's not a genetic disease. It's some combination of those factors that are environmental and genetics and metabolomic and what have you, microbiome, that are going to, in some individuals, make the perfect storm that allows the expression of this.
Right. I mean, and another issue that a lot of people are becoming more aware of with vaccines is that sometimes people go to the doctor and they're told, your child's behind on 8 vaccines. So they get 8 vaccines on the same day, whereas somebody else, you know, might go and get only 2 at a time. And it might be that load of aluminum and other compounds that causes a problem when more are given. Or, for example, preemies in a hospital will be given the same dose of vaccine as a 10-pound baby.
Or as a 60-kilogram adult, yeah.
Right.
And that's true. I mean, look, for example, if you've been taking antibiotics, let's go back to antibiotics. If you've been taking antibiotics for an infection, and you come into your doctor and go, you know, geez, I kind of forgot to take them for a couple of days. He's not going to make you take, or she is not going to make you take all 10 of the antibiotics at once. They're not going to do that. So I would, you know, so the idea that somehow you've got to catch up can only be based on the idea that is fairly current in the medical community that these things are as harmless as pure spring water, and they're not
right.
for everybody.
Yeah.
So
I,
the And, you know, especially when you're dealing with aluminum, I don't know much about the other ingredients in terms of their possible, you know, range of toxicities. But when you're dealing with aluminum, the literature on this is huge, and it goes back quite a long time. And so whenever you say, well, I'm just going to give 10 times more aluminum than in one vaccine, well, you're pushing the envelope a little bit. You can get away with it a lot of the time, probably, but you can't get away with it all the time.
Yes, it probably depends on a lot of factors.
So it's a huge range of factors.
Yes, so let's go to this paper. You retracted it, and two of reasons which I saw were that some of the figures had been changed, and the data had left the University of British Columbia. So can you, let's deal with the figures being changed. Like, do you know how that happened?
No, the short answer is that we do not. Here's what we do know. So we were alerted to this actually with some questions from an organization called PubKeer, that some of the bloggers that wrote on PubKeer saying that some of the figures had appeared to have been manipulated. When we heard this, we instantly took it seriously, because even though we're used to people like ORAC and others, you know, criticizing our methods or our interpretation or our stats or our general knowledge of things, you know, that's part and parcel of the scientific process. We get that. And that's, you know, when we've already been through the peer review process, we're not worried about what ORAC has to say.
Right.
And again, if John Dawson or any editor thinks he's so smart about this stuff, they would invite him to review it, and they didn't.
Right.
So we ignore that. However, when someone says there's data manipulation, we have to take it seriously.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we spent the next 2 days after we heard this, we're now looking at almost 2 weeks ago, or actually longer. And so when we first heard this, we instantly started to look at it. We pulled up the images that we had on our computers, we compared them to the data in the paper, and we agreed that some of the things seemed to have been flipped, and we don't know why. Interestingly enough, most of the ones that seemed to be changed, we even found a few that the bloggers hadn't found. But some of the ones the bloggers claimed had been changed, we don't think were. Having said that, the fact that any of them were changed raises concerns.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So then, of course, the answer to that was to write to the lead author, who is no longer with us, who's now in charge at a program there. We said, can you tell us, you know, what you think about this allegation that these things have been changed? And our own investigation that seems to show something was being flipped. Is there a simple explanation for this? And also, where are the original data? So we can solve this really fast by going right back to the original data and comparing the images. And she wrote back to say she denied that there was any manipulation, but the original data had gone off with her to China when she left the laboratory because she was going to write up the paper. And partially did, and we had later had the paper finished by another person, and that the data had been left in China at the parents' house, and she was no longer on speaking terms with the parents and could not get them back.
That seems a little bit like the dog ate my homework.
It is exactly like the dog ate my homework. So is it true? Maybe. You know, or did the original data exist? Yes, I've seen them. Other people in the lab saw them. So we know they existed, but they're not in the lab, and that is a very clear violation of UBC policy and, of course,
right,
laboratory policy. Original data never leave the lab. It's not to say people don't do it from time to time. You know, you're allowed to copy your own data and take them wherever you want to work on them, but you're not allowed to take the original lab notebooks and the data out.
Right. In terms of original data, are you talking about like Western blots or something?
We're talking about Western blots. We're talking about other kinds of gel blots. We're talking about the lab notebooks. They should never have left, and they did. And so, you know, do we have an explanation why she did it? Well, she violated policy, and you know, we've taken, you know, many steps to get them back. The story about where they are keeps changing. The fact is, we don't have them, and in the absence of having them, there's nothing to compare to.
I assume that when you do Western blots and you're going to be publishing in this digital age, that you take a photograph, and that photograph ends up in the journal, obviously.
Yes.
And if you distribute the photograph to your colleagues, I mean, that's all normal, and they take their laptop home, there's no problem. But to the original Western blot, that seems like a very unusual circumstance. And
well,
why would
you
need that anyway to work on it? If you've got a high quality photograph, like, why do you need the original Western blot?
Well, maybe you look at your photograph again and you say, well, you know, it's a little blurry, or you know, somebody else who read the draft of the manuscript thought, you know, this blotch in the middle of it looked really ugly. Do we have a prettier example? There are a lot of reasons why you might do it, although you should never take the original data out of the lab.
Right.
And you know, UBC has a policy, which we strictly adhere to, that obviously not in this case, but we strictly adhere to it, which is that original data or any publication have to remain in the laboratory for, it's now 4 years, it used to be 7.
Right.
And, you know, and that's what we do. And we have reams of stuff all over the shelves that are in our laboratory that, you know, have stacked up over the years where we just keep it in case something like this ever happens. It's never happened before.
Yeah, because, I mean, if there's a question of manipulating a photograph, you got the original, you just go back and re-photograph and then compare the two things.
Exactly. And, you know, if that had happened, we would have gone to the original photographs, we would have compared them to the things, we would have said, look, you know, if something is flipped over, it's a, you know, innocent error, whoops, here is a fixed photograph, and we would have sent that to John Dawson, that would have been the end of it. But we can't do that. So, you know, at that point, there was no alternative but for me to withdraw paper because we could not justify the original data in their absence.
And you're going to have to do this research again, right?
Because we're going to have to do this research again.
Yeah. Right.
So we are going to do it again. We are looking for remaining tissue from these animals. We are still, you know, hoping we can find it in our freezers. If it's not, but you know, the problem is it's now 3 or 4 years old, and it may have degraded, which does happen for a lot of the molecules in question. And we may just have to do it again. We're doing another series of studies. We're going to try and look for some data. You know, one, if there's a silver lining of this, there aren't many, but if there is one, it's that we originally screened 18 genes and found what we thought was 7 of them that had been changed
in their
expression. What that may mean to us is that we don't have to go back through 18 again, we can just go back to those 7 and try and study it.
Okay, so you have some evidence that the aluminum changed 7 genes in the mouse brain, so you can reduce your cautious by studying those 7s.
Absolutely. And the other thing that to note is that of the images claimed changed, most of those did not involve the data that we claimed were significant. They involved ones that we noted were not significant. So that's kind of odd. Why would one change data that's not significant if it doesn't change the significance? And the answer is, you know, we don't know.
I mean, it's possible. Okay, just hypothesizing, and I know you won't want to do this, but I mean, you could change it to hide the significance, right?
that might be
a motivation.
And as we know, CDC has been accused of doing precisely that. Not with gels, but with their stats. So yes, you can hide it if you don't want significance. You know? And in this case, we were neutral about what was significant or not. You know, we were following aluminum through all the different levels of the nervous system. We were looking at behavior, which we have done and published on. We're looking at cellular changes. We're looking at biochemical changes, which we published on. The next step was to go to the genetic level to see if in fact we were changing gene expression. And that's not so unusual because that's been shown for aluminum before by other investigators. So, you know, were we surprised that we saw it a little bit? Were we shocked and horrified? No, it was what it was. And so, you know, the idea that we would, you know, selectively choose some and not others, it kind of doesn't make sense. You know,
well, yeah.
So I do have an hypothesis. I don't know that it's true. I mean, sometimes, look, every time you read a paper, you see that the authors will say, a typical example is shown.
Right.
Okay, what they mean is the prettiest of the typical examples.
Exactly.
Okay, exactly. And so when you're doing various kinds of gels, be they Westerns or RNA blots, you're going to get blotches and tears and bubbles and crap that you don't want. So you shouldn't do it, but sometimes I think there's a tendency, you know, I don't know if it happened in this case, there's a tendency to say, well, you know, it doesn't matter anyway, let's just clean up this image because otherwise the reviewer is going to jump on it and say it's ugly and you have to redo the experiment. I don't want to do that because I'm now somewhere else. And so I'm just going to, because it doesn't matter, I'm just going to take this ugly thing and park it there. Did that happen? I don't know.
Yeah. A couple of other things I'd like to talk about. One of the things is you use subcutaneous injections of aluminum, and some people commented that actually vaccines are injected intermuscularly.
Most are, yes. Not all, but most. Yeah, right. And so there's a reason for that. The reason for that is when we first got in, and since then we have changed our protocols and we're now doing intramuscular. But for a long time we were doing subcutaneous, and then the reason for that is the initial vaccine study we did, the initial actual aluminum study we did, was following the link between Lou Gehrig's disease that had been made by various investigators and the anthrax vaccine.
Right.
Anthrax vaccine has a bunch of stuff in it, but one of those things is a high level of aluminum adjuvant, which at that time we knew nothing about. The company, Bioport, did not sell us the vaccine, so we started to break the vaccine up, and the suspicion had been that the company was using squalene as a potential adjuvant, as well as aluminum, which they were. So we simply defaulted to those two adjuvants that did the study on that.
Right.
And anthrax vaccine is administered subcutaneous, so we simply were following exactly as in our model system the same sort of thing, subcutaneous injection in young male mice, precisely as we would have done if we'd been studying American soldiers who were getting the vaccine, you know,
right.
American soldiers mostly being young, mostly being male, etc. So that's why we had stayed with that sort of thing. We seemed to get an outcome that seemed to work, and rather than shift protocols all of a sudden and have to go back and do the whole thing again, which we're now doing, is we started with the we kept with the subcutaneous investigation for this next level of investigation. We've done behavior, we've done cellular, we've done molecular, and now we're going to do genetics in the same system.
Right. Okay, so another criticism made by Gorski was that you don't have expertise in measuring gene and protein levels.
Well, I don't know, but Alice Lee, we thought that. So she came to us highly recommended for two other UBC laboratories. And based on the work she had done in those laboratories as a molecular geneticist. So that was the basis of that, yeah. And so I don't, you know, and Gorski doesn't have a lot of expertise in a lot of things he pontificates about either. So that, you know, and that's okay. I mean, you know, you can't know everything, you know, in a field as broad as neuroscience or even into all the techniques.
Right.
You basically bring on people that have that expertise. We first started doing behavioral studies in our mice for various toxins. We didn't have behavioral analysis techniques either. We gained them.
Right.
We brought on people who had those techniques, and then we became fairly proficient at them.
So you're just going to have to find somebody else to do the gene and protein measurements.
Pretty much. But we now have people in our lab who have been trained in this, and they are completely capable of doing it now. So we'll just go back and do this. What we will do is we'll look at, you know, Gorski had a lot of critiques about our use of semi-quantitative PCR. You know, we'll go back and look at that. So is there a better way to do this? Is there a more quantitative, more effective way to do these things? Compared to the way we did it. And you know, we're always trying to look at better ways better methods to probe questions. And we'll do that here. We'll do it here as well. If there are better methods, we'll use it.
Yeah, your research is definitely going to be under very tight scrutiny because a lot of people don't like the idea that you're doing the research.
Yeah, and it'll be under tight scrutiny, and you know we've learned a lot from this incident. I should mention, by the way, this is the third time that a paper that we've been associated with has been attacked. The first one was about a year ago, a paper that came out of the Schoenfeld group. We were only peripherally involved in it, but it was originally published in Vaccine. It was a very strange story on this. I don't know if you're familiar with that. Yehuda Schoenfeld, the senior author, sent it to the journal Vaccine, which is not a choice because Vaccine, as you can guess, is probably pretty pro-vaccine.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Organization. Nevertheless, the paper did go out for review. The associate editor, Daniel Altman, sent it for review. I don't know who the reviewers were, but it came back with reviewer comments that the lead author and Schoenfeld addressed, and it was accepted to Vaccine. It was posted on their website. At that point, obviously somebody got wind of it, and it was about Gardasil, the Gardasil vaccine, and it tested in an animal model. Someone got wind of it, and Greg Poland, who's the editor there, sent it out for re-review.
Wow.
Which is odd, because, well, it is interesting, because Poland, first of all, has ties to Merck, gets funding for Merck, and the Journal of Vaccine gets funding for Merck, and this is a Merck product, the Gardasil vaccine. So it goes out for re-review. Three now people, the reviewers, again anonymous, come back with, you know, a lot of critiques, and basically on the basis of that, without us having a chance to respond, and we actually did try to respond, without us having a chance to respond, Poland pulls it and puts it on the retracted status. The paper subsequently was revised. Yehuda Schoenfeld, the senior author, sent it off somewhere else and was accepted as not the literature. Recently, we had a paper that came out of the Girardi, attacked by two individuals who misstated their credentials to point out what they thought were flaws and omissions in the paper. All these were bogus, and we wrote a response letter to the Journal of Toxicology, which was accepted as now the literature as a response. So that's the second attack, and now this third one. Someone obviously took the time to examine the gels, the pictures of the gels in great detail, blow them up to 20 times magnification, flip them this way and that way to find things. And in this case, they did. Yeah,
yes.
It happened. They were right. I have to say it. They were right.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it's a good thing because why? Otherwise.
But who does that? I mean, who puts these things in that kind of scrutiny? So should we be glad that someone did because they actually caught errors that were made? Yeah, perhaps. But also, it shows that the level of scrutiny is very, very different for anything that is critical of vaccines. And that means for us, we are going to double and triple and quadruple check everything that comes out of our laboratory. We are going to have it vetted by our colleagues. We are going to make sure that the original data are nailed to the wall. We are going to make sure that there is no possibility that there's anything untoward going on. And we'll never let that happen again.
Yes. One last thing I wanted to bring up again from a quote from your paper, which I thought was very interesting. And this is a sort of the preliminary matter. Aluminum used in vaccines is specifically designed to produce a long-lasting immune response, and in this context, rapid excretion of the adjuvant would nullify the very reason it's put in vaccine formulas.
Yes.
And you quote 8 to 10 years following injection for retention of the aluminum.
Yeah.
And also you mention the tight association of vaccine antigen with DNA or other vaccine excipients. I'm not sure what an excipient is.
You know, David, I apologize. I didn't get any of that.
Okay, I was saying that the attention to aluminum is very important because not only is it absorbed in the vaccine at a very high level, but it stays in your body for much longer than you would have expected.
It appears to do so, yes.
Yes.
And that, again, that work comes out of the Girardi group, and we have a lot of faith in that laboratory. They do very, very, very serious quantitative science, and they can trace aluminum in the CNS. So, yes, I believe that's probably true.
Okay. Well, I don't know if there's anything else you'd like to add. I know you don't have a lot of time today.
Listen, you know, I don't really care what David Gorski, the Gorskis of the world, think. Again, you know, blogs are blogs, and you can say anything you want them. Again, he is fairly ignorant about a lot of things we're talking about. I don't worry about the other people, you know, the trolls and the others who are out there to, you know, basically diss anything that we do. What I do feel bad about is the people who have looked to our research as, you know, illuminating aspects of vaccine safety, and I think we've let them down, and I really, really regret that. And we obviously have a lot of work to do to repair the faith those people had in us, and I will take that as a challenge. I will make that our goal, to make sure that the next stuff that comes out of our laboratory cannot be questioned. I mean, it can always be questioned from methodology, because that's always going to happen no matter what, but it will never be questioned again on the basis of any kind of data alterations. And we will ensure that we do everything in our power to repair the reputation of the laboratory and all the people that work in it.
Okay, well, thank you very much for joining me today, Chris.
You're welcome.
Appreciate
David.
It.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, we got some time, so let's talk about free speech. We're all in favor of it, right? Unless it offends us, and then it's not free speech, it's something else. Maybe we're not allowed to say it because we're on private property, or we're interfering with somebody else's free speech rights, or it can be conceived as violence of some kind or some other excuse. I'm not trying to pretend I'm a free speech absolutist. I agree that there's speech that should be forbidden or controlled. Absolute freedom of speech would take us into some very dark places. Most decent people would object to speech that's based on a crime, such as a video of a rape or of sexual activity, including a child, or speech that advocates harming or killing some class of people. But on the other hand, there are lots of attempts at censorship, some successful, and they're on both the left and the right. Let's talk about them. Conservatives in the U.S., whether Republicans or the alt-right, are vigorously in favor of free speech, but they seem to be quiet when they're the ones suppressing speech. These two currents came into view when the University of Wisconsin, which is Republican-controlled, advanced a new policy that would suspend students who had twice engaged in, quote, violence or other disorderly conduct. Well, I suppose the police can deal with violence, but disorderly conduct could involve free speech, such as yelling at a speaker you think is hateful, or a noisy demonstration outside a hall where somebody's speaking. According to University Regent Regina Miller, I don't consider drowning out another speaker as freedom of speech. That doesn't qualify. But that is speech, and the policy is suppressing the freedom of speech of students in order to protect any right-wing speech because people like Milo Yiannopoulos, that the university might invite. I don't think the right to listen substitutes for the right to free speech. Interestingly, Jeff Sessions has condemned campus speech and civility codes. Students at the University of Florida certainly outnumbered and drowned out the Nazi Richard Spencer. Taxpayers were left paying his $600,000 bill for security just so that his free speech rights could be asserted. But the free speech rights of the protesters were louder and more numerous. An anecdote in an October 19th Miami Herald article about Spencer's speech, if you can call it that, it didn't last very long, that struck me was when Seth Smith, an Iraq war veteran, was turned away because he uses a cane due to a war wound. Eli Mosley, CEO of the white supremacy group Identity Europa, was heard saying, "Push him out, get him out of here," which is reminiscent of Trump's rhetoric. Ironically, the rumor is that Mosley is Jewish, and some white supremacists are arguing whether their hatred of Muslims and Mexicans is sufficient that they can welcome Jews like him into their midst, especially those who believe that the world is run by a Jewish cabal of bankers and Hollywood elites. Identity Europa advocates for racial segregation. I guess they'll have to argue about how many states there will be and who will get the minorities that don't conveniently fit into whatever categories they create when they're building fences. Just to prove that the left can be as crazy as the right, God invented Drexel University professor George Ciccariello Maher. He doesn't defend free speech rights for those he despises, and that's quite a list. According to an article in The Intercept, he advocated for protests against Charles Murray. We'll get to him later. With the protests ending in violence, he was opposed to gun control after the Las Vegas massacre, not because of the Second Amendment, because of white supremacist patriarchy. He's called for police officers to be killed, advocated rioting and vigilante mass murder, and praised the murder of white people during the Haitian rebellion that resulted in freed slaves taking over the island. Finally, his university that had long supported his right to free speech while expressing disgust with what he was saying put him on leave, according to them, for his own safety. So now he experiences the feeling of having his free speech rights quashed. It wasn't really political. It was animal rights protesters that shut down the show Art in China after 1989 at the Guggenheim in New York City. The New York Times described the three controversial works as a video showing two heavily tattooed pigs mating before an audience, another showing pit bulls straining to fight while chained to non-motorized treadmills, and a clear dome filled with hundreds of insects and reptiles, many of which will die over time. I don't think I'd like to see this, but do I want to shut it down? Trump's administration went after the complete list of people who registered on the Disrupt J20 site, which was set up to protest, to coordinate protests of Trump's inauguration. Why did they need the 1.3 million IP addresses of everyone who accessed the site, and the names of people who registered on the site? The ISP, DreamHost, fought back, seeing this as a way to deter people from exercising their free speech right to demonstrate. According to ZDNet, a court sided with the ISP almost totally, allowing them to exclude all personal identifying information from what they had to turn over to law enforcement. If there is evidence of a crime that emerges, law enforcement can come back for unredacted records for that person, i.e. including their identifying information. Back to the Trump administration, over 30 Georgetown law professors took a knee to protest Jeff Sessions speaking on free speech at their faculty. Their reason was his hypocrisy. He's not only working for a president who wants NFL players fired for exercising their free speech rights, but Sessions has long been involved with voter suppression, and voting is an act of speech. Sessions was also in charge of the law enforcement agencies demanding to disrupt J20 records. Finally, and perhaps most hypocritically, he leads the DOJ that is pressing charges against a woman who laughed at him during his confirmation hearing. The audience for Sessions' speech was tightly controlled, with a number of students being disinvited, perhaps out of fear that they'd exercise their free speech rights while Sessions was pontificating on free speech. In a category of absurd news, a Republican lawmaker in Indiana is putting forward the law to require journalists to be licensed by police. Really, what he's doing is protesting calls for the registration of guns. I guess if you're a politician with something to hide, a journalist could be more threatening than a gun. And now we get to the Cub Scouts. A Republican legislator indirectly caused a Cub Scout to get kicked out of his den in Colorado. Miss Marble, the Republican state senator in question, was present to answer questions from the boys. Ames Mayfield, aged 11, according to the New York Times October 22nd article, stated, "I was shocked that you co-sponsored a bill to allow domestic violence offenders to continue to own a gun. Why on earth would you want somebody who beats their wife to have access to a gun?" Apparently, the Cub Pack didn't think that inviting Cub Scouts to answer a politician questions would result in a tough political question. He was told to leave and find another den. The senator was avoiding the press. Republican Bob Corker, who is retiring in 2018, said that the White House had become an adult daycare center. Steve Bannon, who appears to be still running offense for the White House, called for his resignation. Not just Corker, but also Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and the rest of the, quote, globalist clique on Capitol Hill. Down under, Australia is having a referendum on gay marriage. Grammy-winning rapper Macklemore wanted to perform Same Love in favor of gay marriage at a National Rugby League game, and some conservative politicians and opponents of gay marriage wanted to silence him, to silence his right to sing what he wanted. Generally, rugby fans were positive, but Macklemore stated, "I'm getting a lot of tweets from angry old white dudes in Australia." On the other side of the political spectrum, political correctness went wild in Toronto when the school board banned the word chief, at least from job titles, on the basis that it was insulting to Indigenous people. They admitted there'd been no complaints, and it doesn't appear that they consulted with Indigenous people either, although there were a few natives who supported the move. Perhaps the most concise ridicule, and there was a lot of ridicule, came from Indigenous writer and educator Robert Jago, who tweeted, "Dear teachers, stop using us as an excuse to act stupid." It's true that the term chief was imposed on Native Canadians by the Indian Act, but that's probably the least of the traumas that they suffered due to that act and the acts of settlers in Canada. And I don't see how taking the term from the chief janitor at a high school is going to help Native Canadians suffering from numerous social problems in Canada's cities, most notably poverty and the legacy of broken families from Canada's residential school system, that tore young children from families, subjected them to an austere system and frequently to physical and sexual abuse, which resulted in them becoming dysfunctional parents. And the cycle, unfortunately, continues. Getting back to political scientist Charles Murray, and I certainly don't think that politics and science should ever be used in the same sentence, let alone the same phrase, I'd be interested in hearing him speak, even though I think he is a racist. For example, he has stated that poor people are that way because they have poor genes, pun intended. Quoting him directly, "Try to imagine a GOP Republican presidential candidate saying in front of the cameras, 'One reason that we still have poverty in the United States is that a lot of poor people are born lazy.' You cannot imagine it because that kind of thing cannot be said. And yet this unimaginable statement merely implies that when we know the complete genetic story, it will turn out that the population below the poverty line in the United States has a configuration of the relevant genetic makeup that is significantly different from the configuration of the population above the poverty line. That is not unimaginable, it is almost certainly true." The statement is interesting because the logical fallacy is obvious. He is presupposing that we will eventually discover data to support his beliefs. He's really inventing the data. And he's admitting that he didn't have the data, the evidence at that time, which was around 2000. Given that black people have a different genetic makeup from white people, there certainly will be a correlation between some genes and poverty. It's just that it won't be causative. It would be another fallacy to assume that the genes caused the poverty directly and not that the genes merely caused black skin, which caused a host of societal factors such as job discrimination, housing discrimination, poorer schools, and greater likelihood of imprisonment, all of which lead to poverty. So I guess the genes did, in a manner of speaking, cause the poverty, just not in the way that Charles Murray implied. I'd hope that university students could take his views as an opportunity to deconstruct scientific-sounding ideas to show that they are really just putting icing on excrement. Now let's talk about Harvey Weinstein. Everybody else is. I'm certainly not going to defend him. I think everybody recognizes him as a monster, yet another powerful man using his power to subjugate women. I sense that his behavior wasn't so much about sex as his need to humiliate women, wherever that came from. If there's a hero in this story, it's Ambra Batalana Gutierrez. Like many women, she met with Weinstein and was groped. She claimed he put his hand on her breasts and tried to put his hand up her skirt. Unlike many women, she not only told a friend in detail what happened, detailed enough that it could be used as evidence in court, but she complained to the police. The police also did their job and took her complaint seriously, despite the fact that the complaint was against an incredibly powerful man. She agreed to wear a wire, and the transcript is now famous. He essentially admitted that he had sexually molested her. Then DA Cyrus Vance Jr. decided not to pursue charges. Other legal experts have noted that you'll probably never get better evidence than gathered by The Wire when she asked Weinstein, "Why yesterday did you touch my breast?" And he answered, "I won't do it again. Come on, sit here for a minute, please," as he tried to entice her into his hotel room. In unrelated news, Cyrus Vance Jr. later received campaign contributions from Weinstein's defense lawyer. This lends credence to the belief that it's futile to pursue charges of this nature against a powerful man, until, that is, the dam breaks and enough people come forwards at the same time, as essentially happened in Ronan Farrow's New Yorker article. There are really two things to do when you find out that someone has been sexually assaulted by a powerful man, either directly when it's against you or when you hear it from somebody else. You can do nothing, or you can press charges or sue. Nobody's criticizing the many women who kept silent, some not telling anyone, and quite a few going back for more meetings with Weinstein, because their careers were at stake. And some people are criticizing men who knew but did nothing. This seems unfair because the men only found out secondhand. If they had found out firsthand, then certainly they should have done something. And given that most women didn't want to press charges or sue, they probably couldn't have done anything. A man finding out from a female friend that they'd been molested by Weinstein couldn't go to the police unless the woman was going to cooperate. Some men did act. Gwyneth Paltrow confided in her then-boyfriend Brad Pitt, who confronted Weinstein, who then turned around and threatened to fire Paltrow if she ever said anything. And he certainly had the power to destroy careers. Canadian actress Erica Rosenbaum, interviewed by CBC Radio's As It Happens, remembers how Weinstein said when she first met him that he could make careers and also break them, an implied threat that surfaced when he first molested her. It seems hard to understand how she went back for more, but Weinstein was apparently good at manipulating the situation, so what seemed like a meeting with others in an office suddenly turned into a meeting alone in his hotel room. Seth MacFarlane was criticized for making a joke at the Oscars in 2013, saying to the Oscar winners, "Ladies, you no longer have to pretend to be attracted to Harvey Weinstein." Some felt he was making a joke at the expense of women who may well have been assaulted by Weinstein. But how else could he make his concerns public? He did this because actress Jessica Barth had told him about Weinstein's behavior against her. Afterwards, Barth came out and defended MacFarlane, saying, "To the people slamming Seth for not doing anything, please stop. He stood by me and respected my wishes that he not retaliate in any way." And it's not just richly powerful men who do this. Two NYPD officers had sexual relations with a woman in handcuffs, and after she reported rape and samples taken from her contained the officer's DNA, they stated that the sex was consensual. Apparently, it's not a crime for a police officer in New York to have consensual sex with someone they're arresting, despite the fact that the concept of consensual sex in such a situation is nonsense. Sex with a powerful movie mogul who has stated that he can make or break your career is no more consensual than sex with a woman when she's physically helpless, inebriated completely, or restrained by handcuffs. Since Weinstein, there's been a flood of allegations against powerful men in the entertainment industry. The head of the Canadian company that produces Just for Laughs, for example, was another to suddenly resign. And it's not just using their power against women. In some cases, it was against men. And it's not just the entertainment industry or police, and it's not just now. A fascinating new book by Blaine Harden, King of Spies, The Dark Reign of America's Spymaster in Korea, not only details how Donald Nichols was America's top spymaster during the Korean War, how he befriended the American-supported dictator of South Korea, even attending torture sessions and executions, having his photo taken with a severed head in a bucket beside him, but how he had an appetite for young men which was fed by the U.S. Air Force, who supplied them to him, despite the fact that homosexuality was cause for dismissal at the time. But his power made him so important to the Americans that qualms are thrown out the window, until one day the military had had enough and put him in an insane asylum. I guess you'll have to read the book. Sometimes the issue of consent is unclear, such as when two drunk people make out. But in these cases, Weinstein, the NYPD police officers, in the light of day, there'd be no question about the consent. It's the fact that power can keep these transgressions in the dark. Will that change? And how will it change? Thank you for listening to episode 159 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.